Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Today's episode is the last of 2014, as I'll be away spending the holidays with family. For a bit of a year-end summary of Canada's economy, my only guest is Jim Stanford, chief economist at Unifor, Canada's largest private sector union, and author of the popular economics book, Economics for Everyone. He'll join me for an extended conversation. As you'll hear, our chat touches on everything from the consequences of the falling oil price, to the new batch of free trade agreements, to Canada's economic standing 6 years out from the global meltdown, all the way to popular economics education and its lessons for today. Without further ado, then, my conversation with Jim Stanford. So, Jim, I can't help but start with the biggest economic news of the last few months, and that's the rapid fall in the oil price, which has lost something like 40% of its value since the summer. What's your take on the effect this is having, specifically in Canada, and the effect that it will have in the very near future on our economy?
Well, one thing is it's like deja vu all over again. Anyone who is surprised by a sharp decline in the price of a global commodity obviously hasn't studied anything about world history. What goes up must come down, and that rule is especially true of any resource-based commodities, whether it's pork bellies or plutonium or crude oil. And we had to know that the price at $100 a barrel or higher was not going to be sustained in the long run. And anyone who thought that Canada's economic roads would be paved with crude oil fortunes was either wishful thinking or deliberately misleading the rest of us. So this is a par for the course. If you look at the history of oil prices, it is a roller coaster ride. We could focus on the specific factors that have caused this downturn, such as the recent OPEC meeting, which decided to not try to control supply and prop up the price, to supply side issues like this boom in shale oil from the United States and so on. But really, it's almost in a way beside the point. The reality is commodity prices cycle over the long run, and this should have been expected by everyone.
So maybe a bit more broadly, just how important then is the oil and gas sector to the Canadian economy? We hear the term petrostate thrown around a lot. Are we a petrostate either already or in the making?
Well, our economy is certainly not a petro economy. Our government may have some aspects of being a petro state in terms of how the politics shake out and in terms of the disproportionate influence which the oil industry wields at the provincial level in places like Alberta and Saskatchewan, and obviously at the federal level with the Harper Conservatives, whose political power base is very much in the oil industry. But there's a difference between a petro state and a petro economy. The oil and gas extraction sector, directly measured, accounts for less than 5% of Canada's GDP. So, yes, it is an important industry. It's an important source of jobs, particularly in the western provinces. It's become our most important export, more by default than anything else, because of the collapse of our other manufactured exports. But it is not the engine of Canada's economy, and that's where the rhetoric and the reality part ways once again. All of the self-interested ballyhooing from the oil industry over the last decade, that everyone in Canada had a great stake in the oil sands boom, that the oil industry was making everyone better off, et cetera, was never justified. And the reality is Canada has a big, very diversified economy. Oil is one important sector, but the whole country will not rise or fall with the price of oil. In fact, there's many parts of Canada's economy that will benefit from lower oil prices. There's no doubt about it.
So basically, something that's producing winners and losers, and now it's sort of, turned in the other direction a bit.
Oh, certainly. So, you know, some of the sectors that will benefit from lower oil prices, obviously any transportation industry that uses fuel as an input. So everything from taxi drivers to trucking to airlines is going to benefit from this decline in the price of an important input. Sectors that export other than resources are clearly going to benefit, because one of the direct side effects of the lower oil price has been a decline in the Canadian dollar coming back towards normal levels. It's still too high, but I expect it will get back to what we would consider a normal exchange rate, something around 80 cents US in short order. And that means that all of our exports that were priced out of the market during the oil boom, and that's not just manufacturing, it also includes tradable services, which have declined, or tourism, which has done terribly during the oil era. All of those industries are going to benefit from the lower dollar. In fact, the oil industry itself benefits from a lower dollar. That's often forgotten. The sliding dollar is actually cushioning a bit of the blow of the lower oil price by meaning that the revenues that are obtained from our oil look bigger in Canadian dollar terms than they would without the decline in the dollar. And I think in a way, the most important benefit is one to our sort of our culture, if you like, our policy culture. It's a sudden wake-up call for those who thought that Canada's whole future could be secured by pigeonholing ourselves as the extractors of a non-renewable resource. And that strategy is so short-sighted and so dangerous. Yet, as long as the oil price was above $100, people got dollar signs in their eyeballs and they forgot about the risks. Suddenly, people have remembered the risks. And if there's a silver lining, it may be that it forces us to wake up and smell the greenhouse gases, perhaps, is one way to put it, and think about other things that we can focus on doing as a country.
Right. So maybe we could take this long view for a second then. We're nearing the end of 2014, so we're 6 or 7 years out from the biggest economic crisis to hit the global economy since the Great Depression. How has Canada come through this period as a whole, looking not just at oil, but everything together, and what do we look like this many years out from this crisis?
The meltdown, of course, happened more than six years ago. The official recovery began in the summer of 2009, so more than 5 years ago. Canada, of course, was not hit as directly as some other economies, in particular the United States and Europe. We had no banks that collapsed, and so we didn't have quite the same extreme damage done from the financial meltdown as did America and Europe, among other jurisdictions. And that, of course, sparked a lot of backslapping, you know, by our policymakers for the first couple of years. It was like, gee, aren't we great? Canada's the role model. We were prudent. We had somewhat stronger financial regulations, which is true. It was no thanks to our current government. Those regulations have been there for decades. But they did help to protect us. And initially, you know, this oil expansion was a source of export revenues and some incomes, although, again, that was always overstated. The sheen has really come off of Canada's self-congratulatory reputation, though. Starting around 2012 and then especially 2013 and 2014, Canada's economic recovery really got stuck in the mud. And we've really made no more progress towards job creation and undoing the damage from the recession since about 2013, for about 2 years. And in the meantime, other countries, the U.S. and Britain in particular, have really got some new momentum and have surpassed us in terms of economic dynamism. So Canada does not look very good internationally. That self-congratulatory rhetoric that dominated the narrative in the first couple years after the recession and the financial crisis really did us a disservice, because our policymakers, you know, became very passive and said there's nothing we need to do. We're better than anyone else in the world. In fact, Prime Minister Harper actually said that. It's incredible. He actually said, literally, the words were, "Our economy is the envy of the entire world." And if that really is your mindset as the leader of the country, it absolutely demonstrates you have no sense of what's going on out there in the economy, because millions of Canadians are suffering. There's at least 2 million Canadians unemployed, many more underemployed. And if all you can do is say we're the best, then you're going to miss the problem signs, and you're not going to take the actions that are required. So even before the downturn in the oil price, Canada's bloom was fading, and now I think our structural vulnerabilities are laid bare for the whole world to see.
And what are some of these structural things that you know, other than say the over reliance on some commodities that we've already talked about?
Our economy, in structural terms, has really regressed since the turn of the century. I date it back to around the year 2001, 2002. When the you know, global commodity upswing started, the governments began to put primary emphasis on resource projects and resource exports. We started becoming, you know, infatuated with all these proposals like the different export pipelines and so on. The currency took off, and our manufacturing sector began a very long and dramatic decline. Since that time, we've become far more reliant on the extraction and export of unprocessed natural resources to pay our way in international trade. And we aren't paying our way in international trade. That's one of the problems. Even when oil prices were $100 a barrel, we had a huge trade deficit that has emerged in the range of $50 billion a year. And that's going to get much worse. That's a current account balance deficit that includes merchandise trade, services trade, tourism, and so on. That's going to get much worse now that the oil price is collapsing. And then we've had a very long-term underperformance in the whole area of innovation, technology, R&D, productivity growth. Canada has been one of the worst performers of all the industrial countries in terms of how much we dedicate to developing new products, new services, new processes. And so our productivity growth has been absolutely abysmal, among the worst in the world for any industrial countries. And that's another side effect of the resource dependence. Business investment has been very, very stagnant. We have spent tens of billions of dollars every year on these corporate tax cuts that began, again, at the turn of the century, and there's been no payoff at all. In fact, the business investment effort is weaker than it was before the tax cuts were implemented. So all of these kind of structural weaknesses means the general pace of capital investment, innovation, dynamism, income growth in our economy has been very subpar, and it's getting worse, not better.
So capital is not doing its job correctly. What about the picture of labor under these conditions? How are workers getting by?
Well, we obviously, as workers in society in a capitalist economy, we are dependent on capitalists, the owners of businesses, to push the green button called go. Capitalism works when companies invest money, start new businesses, produce new products, and hire new workers. And their performance in that regard has been quite poor. So, again, we were not the worst hit during the original downturn, the 08-09 downturn. The American labor market was hit much worse than ours was. But we have not recovered, and now the American labor market has a lower unemployment rate, much, much faster job creation than Canada does. So it's kind of interesting. If you look at the unemployment rate is still high, but it has come down a bit since the recession. It's around 6.5% now in Canada. And that's mostly, however, because people gave up looking. Labor force participation has declined. So that means people aren't employed, but they disappear from the official statistics. I prefer right now to look at a measure called the employment rate, which is the proportion of working age people who actually have a job. And the employment rate today is no higher than it was in the summer of 2009, the worst moment of the recession. So from the labor market's perspective, it still feels like a recession, even though we've been in so-called recovery for over 5 years. And that feeling is validated by the statistics. Even the jobs that are there, of course, almost half of them this year have been new jobs, have been part-time. Precarious work is everywhere. So it's not just the inadequate quantity of jobs, it's the declining quality of jobs that's a big part of the problem.
I want to track back a second to some of the structural aspects you mentioned, because I know you've written a lot lately about free trade. And I think this is sold as as a kind of panacea for a lot of these problems. You know, it'll help us deal with account imbalances, external account imbalances. It'll, you know, drive capital and innovation to the right sectors. All this, and we know it's been a big part of the Harper government's policy, and I think, you know, his legacy that he's crafting. We've just recently signed pacts with Korea, I think Honduras, you know, negotiating that big free trade deal with the EU called CETA. What's the main argument against these deals that you've been making?
Well, I first of all, I accept the idea that we need trade. I think that's kind of in a way, a straw man that the free trade proponents put up there. They say anyone who disagrees with the free trade agreement must oppose trade, and that's nonsense. Of course, trade and travel and exchange of ideas and technology and even international investment, those are all things that are obviously central to the economy we live in today, and part of Canada's problem over the last decade has been an inadequate amount of trade, both the quantity, as I mentioned, we've got a large trade deficit, we aren't exporting enough, and the quality or the composition of our trade, which has become so dependent on resource extraction. So we do need more trade, but we need trade of the right kind, and we need trade that benefits us as opposed to undermines our job security and our ability to earn an income. In theory, in the economic theory that's taught in the university courses, these problems are assumed away because the theory assumes that supply and demand will ensure everyone is fully employed and everyone will get paid according to their productivity, and trade deficits can never arise. And in fact, even in traditional free trade theory, they even assume capital is not mobile between countries, which misses the main point of globalization today. So those theories aren't much of a guide. I think that we need more trade, but signing free trade agreements is very different than promoting trade. Free trade agreements have very little to do with actual trade. The bulk of the text of free trade agreements is more about the rules governing investment, foreign investment, corporate behavior, government regulation. Those are things that aren't directly or even indirectly related to trade in many cases. And the motivation for these agreements has been very much aimed at cementing a certain way of running the global economy and even our national economies. It's very, very business friendly, very biased in favor of businesses and the people who own businesses. So the government, the Harper government, as soon as they got their majority, we all knew this would happen if the Harper government ever got, if the Harper Conservatives ever got a majority, they would put pedal to the metal on free trade agreements, and they have done that. They have actually 20 different sets of free trade negotiations underway right now, and some of them will be huge, so like the agreement with Europe or the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership. They will take the current situation, which is very unfavorable to Canada, where our exports are inadequate. We have large trade deficits. We're totally dependent on resource extraction and export. It will cement that reality and make it incrementally a little bit worse for us. I think instead of that, if we were to really address our trade problems, it would be all about figuring out what can we produce in Canada that's high value, that's innovative, that generates good incomes, and let's produce and export more of that. That has almost nothing to do with trade agreements. So we kind of miss the point when we get so obsessed with free trade debates, pro or con.
Right. And what's the argument then to someone who comes back and says, you know, this is just, you're from a big union, this is just, you know, opportunistic protectionism, industries that are still fighting for their corner of the playground. How do you answer such criticisms that sometimes come out and deflate some of this some of the free trade critiques that are out there?
Yeah, well, they often come to me in particular and my union Unifor and the unions that made up Unifor, the former CAW and the former CEP, and said, listen, these are the same people who opposed NAFTA back in the early 90s. And of course, they're right. We are the ones who oppose NAFTA. So today, Canada has an enormous trade deficit with Mexico. It's about $12 billion a year. Most of that is due to auto imports from Mexico. tens of thousands of jobs in auto and manufacturing have been lost in Canada, and there's an accelerating migration of investment to Mexico. But average Mexicans haven't even benefited from this, because the suppression of free trade unionism and human rights and even basic liberties, this mass death squad assassination of about 50 students in Mexico, is horrifying, and has got no coverage up here, and explains so much about why Mexico is the way it is. So we did oppose NAFTA, and guess what? We were right. There's no economic case that can be made at all that NAFTA benefits Canada. It's clearly been a negative, and what's more, the damage is growing. So, you know, the arguments, they will try to tar the critics rather than respond to our criticisms. I have a PhD in economics, and my PhD dissertation was on the subject of computable models of the economy and how they're used and misused in free trade debates. I know exactly how these models work, and I've shown how they're completely dependent on these phony assumptions about full employment and other unrealistic assumptions. I've done detailed critiques of the models, such as the one they used to claim that the CETA with Europe will generate $12 billion in economic gains for Canada. No one in government has ever responded to that critique. What they do instead is try to tar me and anyone else as, you know, protectionist. And that shows that the free trade debate is dominated by ideology and by politics. And the sad part about it now is even the NDP's gotten in on the action. They've decided that free trade cannot be opposed in the political arena, and so they're now endorsing free trade agreements and the whole theory of free trade, starting with the Canada-Korea deal. And that just shows you what an ideological bandwagon we're against here. It's got nothing to do with the actual economic numbers and everything to do with the politics and the perception that if you oppose a free trade deal, you're somehow a dinosaur and a self-interested lobbyist.
Right. And how do we get past this ideology? Is it just a question of building political power on the one hand? You know, you come from Unifor. It's the union movement is often seen as stagnant and irrelevant, especially by people who want to make these ideological claims.
Stagnant and irrelevant until they argue that we're too powerful and they have to get rid of us. That's the irony.
Well, exactly. Until they're passing right to work laws, but ignoring that side of it, how do we expand? How do we make these arguments more relevant again throughout society? I mean, yeah. You know, what are the day to day, you know, even the sort of economic arguments that we can muster to. Mm-hmm. To speak to the underemployed, the temporary, the unorganized.
Well, there's your there's the million-dollar question right there that we on the progressive side of things, the alter globalization community, have to answer. And I think we have to have a hard discussion. I still believe absolutely in the correctness of our arguments, but in terms of the political value of continuing to mount one campaign against one free trade agreement after another. I don't think that's working for us. So somehow we have to reframe the debate and change the terms of the debate. Some of that will come through careful economic research and education, such as is done by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, you know, our progressive think tank, or groups like the Progressive Economics Forum, or what I try to do in my job as a progressive economist to show that the traditional assumptions are wrong, that there's other ways to think about globalization. Part of it also is going to be in sort of framing and focus. Like, I think we should start, instead of getting sucked into a debate over another free trade agreement, we should start our own discussion. Why is Canada's trade performance so lousy? Again, in both quantity and quality, we aren't exporting enough and we're exporting the wrong stuff. Why is that? Is it because we don't have enough free trade agreements? Of course not. And that's where we would get into a discussion about the structural weakness of our economy, the failure of Canada's business community to invest in innovation and research, to satisfy themselves with digging stuff out of the ground and exporting it when the price is high. That way we can have a bigger discussion about the failures of not just free trade agreements, but the whole free market model of economic development, and where maybe we could get some resonance with Canadians instead of being painted wrongly as opposing something that's free. Free trade. How can you be against that?
Right. It sounds magical and wonderful. For the last couple of minutes, I want to switch tracks. And actually, this comes right out of what you were saying. I know you have a book called Economics for Everyone, and it's coming out in a second edition next year. What's the motivation to write a book like this? And what does it mean to make economics accessible? And I guess this goes back to precisely to your last comments as well.
Yes. Well, the title of my book, Economics for Everyone, is itself, in a way, a political statement. You know, in my whole career as a progressive economist, I've been at great pains to emphasize that economics can't be left to the economists. We can't accept the idea that it's a technical, mysterious, mathematical discipline that only experts can understand. We need to have a sort of a popular literacy in economics, and you know, even if you can't, you know, even if you're not going to draw charts and graphs and so on, you have to have enough sense of where you fit into the economy as a human being, as a worker, and what your economic interests are. And in fact, people know that. People know that in their guts, and they know that from their day-to-day life. It's just that it's browbeaten out of them by this phony idea that only experts can comment on economics. So the idea of Economics for Everyone actually came out of a course that we were developing through my former union, the Canadian Auto Workers, the CAW, a course on economics for trade unionists, and we still offer this course every year. And that's where you have to put it in, first of all, bread and butter language. You know, it can't be technical and mathematical. Secondly, you relate the study of economics to people's day-to-day experience as workers, as citizens, as consumers, as taxpayers. And then try to challenge the biases that are implicit in modern economic policy debates. So that was the idea. The book was what started out as a course for the union became a book for broader public use, and that was published in mid 2008, just as the world economy was slipping into that unprecedented recession and financial crisis. Now, a few years later, it's time to update it, and so the second edition will come out from Pluto Books in Britain and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and Fernwood Books here at home. The next edition will come out next summer, and then there's a whole bunch of popular education materials that go with it for free on a website, like glossaries, course outlines, lecture notes, student exercises, etc., so that any union or community group or environmental group could run its own course in popular economics. That's my goal, is to try and make economics something that we can use for us instead of being used against us.
What do you think are the biggest... I think we've seen a bit of a resurgence of economic debate and of the left taking economics sort of more seriously again. What do you think are the biggest stumbling blocks to a bigger sort of popular economic debate? Is it the left that's given up on popularizing economics and retreated into sort of cultural theory? Is it obfuscation on the part of economists and the right? Is it this whole mass of things?
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. I do know that there's a great hunger for it, you know, in the work that I do, both within the union and in the broader community. People are hungry to learn alternatives. And I think it's, again, because they know in their gut that what they're being force-fed on TV with the daily market updates and what they're hearing from the financial pages and so on is not actually true. But they don't know where to start in critiquing it. So I in my experience, not just among activists, but even among average people in our communities, there's quite a hunger to learn about alternative ways of looking at the economy and obviously alternative economic policies and directions for our society. So whatever the barriers are, I think we can overcome them.
Final very quick question then. What are you know, the two or three in a sentence, what are the two or three sort of most important popular economic lessons for today?
First lesson is that all value added starts with the work that we do as human beings. Second lesson is we start with nature. We have to have a place to work and resources to use, so we've got to treat nature sustainably. Thirdly, there's nothing inevitable or uncontrollable about the economy. The economy is just how we as human beings treat each other in the course of doing that work. So anything that's in the economy can be changed if we decide we want to change it.
All right. Thanks so much, Jim Stanford. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Miguel.
That was Jim Stanford, chief economist at Unifor. That's all for this year. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, all the best in the new year, and see you in 2015.